ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Charismatic, rich, stylish, glamorous. Christopher and Pixie Skase were the it couple of the 80s.
Getting an invitation to a Skase party was prized real estate.
But when their business empire teeters, it's Pixie who pays a massive price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If it hasn't been tariffs or the explosion in the share prices of firms such as NVIDIA and OpenAI pushing what were once little known names into the stratosphere, the steady drumbeat of the year has been regularly falling interest rates. On Tuesday, the Reserve Bank made it pretty clear that in Australia, that drumbeat has stopped. There was no November interest rate cut this week. There'll almost certainly be no December rate cut next month. And one reading of what the Reserve Bank said is that there may not be another one at all. Not next year, not at all. What's happened to stop the music? Are we in for both higher inflation and higher unemployment? And might that be the least of our problems? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my returning guests, both of whom are Reserve Bank tragics, as am I. Michael Pascoe, who's been tracking the decisions of the bank since the days when it didn't used to announce them. Remember that, before 1990? Michael's worked for most of Australia's leading newspapers and the Nine Network, and now writes for Michael West Media. And independent economist Nikki Hutley, who's lived and breathed Reserve Bank decisions as a senior economist and chief economist at all manner of institutions, and is now a counsellor with the Climate Council. Welcome back, Michael. Welcome back, Nikki.
Pleasure to be here, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Michael, one interpretation of what the governor said on Tuesday is that she's forecasting inflation well above the top of her 2-3% target band, as much as 3.7% by the middle of next year, 3.2 on an underlying basis, and that her board can't cut rates because its target is the middle of that band, 2.5%, not 3%, not merely being within the band. That was the question she was asked at the press conference you were at.
The answer to that is yes. The board is very definitely targeting 2.5%. Just below 3% is not good enough for the board. When you take those inflation forecasts at face value with the one more interest rate cut in there, what that's telling you is it's really an interesting question about whether there's many more rate cuts left to come.
What she was referring to there is the one rate cut she had to factor into her forecasts, the so-called technical assumption put in there to be in line with market expectations. If she doesn't cut at any time next year, that technical assumption won't apply and inflation will be lower, which is what she wants. So she won't cut. Now, I got the logic right.
Up to a point, Minister. I viewed a surprise in the Reserve Bank on Tuesday, both in some of the stuff Governor Bullock said, some of the stuff that Assistant Governor Economics Sarah Hunter said, and between the lines of the Statement on Monetary Policy. To put it in terms of the Reserve Bank aviary, we normally talk about a fight between doves and hawks. Mm. I think what the governor was saying is the penguins are back in town.
The penguins.
The emperor penguins who famously just sit pat on the egg right through the miserable Antarctic winter. In total darkness, they don't move and they are very happy to sit pat.
You say she's not jumpy. They're not jumpy. They don't want to be jumpy in any direction.
I suspect central bankers regard a long period of stable rates, if the health of the economy is reasonable, as wonderfully successful. Remember that period when Glenn Stevens was governor? I think there were a couple of years they didn't move rates. I accused them of being paid for doing nothing.
I remember that.
But they thought they were doing a great job, and arguably they were. I think the RBA at the moment is hoping to be able to be emperor penguins, sit pat, and see what happens next year sometime without pressure one way or the other. Look, there were enough quotes in the document and the press conference to cherry pick and make a case almost any way you like. A couple of quotes from the governor that I particularly like were, quote, "We are confident inflation is going to come down and we're at the right spot we need to be at the moment." And it's meeting by meeting. Now, that sounds like someone who's pretty happy that things are under control. And the key thing about that inflation jump in the September quarter, and the surprise, I think, of the day, was the Reserve Bank pretty firmly said they're prepared to look through that. They accepted that that was...
There was a very big inflation number, unexpected.
Unexpected, more than a material miss by the governor's own previous wording, but stressed by Sarah Hunter, by the governor, was that there are a lot of one-offs involved, that there are only two areas that look sticky, and the rest they were prepared to wear.
So you're saying the Reserve Bank is being not like a hawk?
No, it's being like a penguin.
And it could have cherry-picked to be like a hawk. How did you see it, Nikki?
I'm going to come up with a quote too, but this is from the statement on monetary policy, which is key risk number two. The period of subdued growth in domestic activity could be more persistent, or the recovery in activity could be stronger. Now, wow, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but no shit, Sherlock. I don't know how many people at the Reserve Bank we're paying to come up with this stuff, but it's pretty well, you know, I don't even think you need an economics degree to come up with that particular forecast.
And those words, highly uncertain, appeared in the statement more than once.
As they have done for, you know, basically since the COVID pandemic. And to be fair, there is a higher degree of uncertainty in the global environment. I think less uncertainty in the domestic environment. And I think Michael's right. And I love this emperor penguin analogy. I'm going to steal it from you, Michael, because they're not wanting to look one way or the other. They don't want to be hawks or doves. They don't want to give out a message. But the review and the idea that we have these more transparent meetings, more transparent press conferences, is to give us greater elucidation on the thinking of the central bank. And I reckon we've got less. I'm starting to worry whether actually this was a bad idea.
There is a strong argument for saying less and letting people think you know stuff. Mm. Whereas they're saying more and confessing that, no, they don't know. Which is honest, but perhaps not what market confidence requires.
Well, she even referred in this everywhere all at once sort of mode, and maybe I'm wrong and there's not a secret plan to push up rates. Maybe she really doesn't know what's going on, but while saying she doesn't know, she said a whole lot of things. There was even an allusion to tradies pushing up prices and a suggestion that, we better stop wanting to employ as many people. She said that in some parts of the economy, home building and renovations, there's more demand for workers than there is supply. And she used what appeared to be a personal example.
I don't know how many people have tried to get a tradie perhaps to work on their house. It's difficult. What that's telling you is that in that microcosm of the Australian economy, the demand for these services is above supply, and when that happens, inflation tends to rise.
Nikki, is she saying there that we need a little less demand for workers, a little less concern about employment, which, if applied across the economy, would mean fewer people in jobs?
Yeah, this really worries me, this attitude that we'll fix the problem by giving the economy less oomph. We've got forecasts out for 2% growth. Now, for the Australian economy, I know this was what we had prior to COVID, but quite frankly, there was a lot of criticism of the Reserve Bank for letting it go that slow for that long prior to COVID. This is not the economy that we want. We want to have more oomph. We need to be able, something's gone fundamentally wrong when at 2% growth and 4.5% unemployment, we've got to wham the brakes on. There is a structural issue here that nobody is talking about. It's the elephant in the room in terms of economic policy. And it may not be, in fact, it probably isn't the Reserve Bank's mandate to fix those issues, but they should, given that full employment is part of their mandate in terms of monetary policy. They should at least be calling it out and saying, we want to do more, but hey, we can't because of these other reasons. And we need to have a good look at ourselves as to what we're doing wrong, because clearly we are doing something wrong. And certainly people's jobs shouldn't be the casualty out of all of this.
Is the governor right, Michael, that as soon as we start to grow the economy a bit, you know, vaguely like we used to, we will be hit with high inflation? And so she's like, I think of it not so much as a penguin as a rabbit in the spotlight.
Or perhaps a turkey, if we're going to stick with the birds.
Yeah, the avian.
Look, I think that particular mention of tradies came up in answer to a question where the governor was looking for an example to explain something. And it was obviously a reference to that sticky problem of housing dwelling costs not behaving and looking like not behaving into the future. I've got an economist friend who sent me a note that really would go to Nikki's heart, I think. He points out a couple of interesting things. On the hard numbers, aside from the rise in the unemployment figure, the unemployment percentage, Australia has added a measly total of about 38,000 jobs since April. The employment to population ratio is 0.3 of a percentage point lower, yet the labour market keeps on being characterised by the Reserve Bank as a little tight. Only a little less tight and still a bit tight.
Well, it obviously is if you're getting an extension on your house.
Obviously, yeah. If you're in that particular market.
So the bank should be far more concerned about employment, whereas, as she said, you know, we're concerned about employment, but much more concerned about inflation right now.
I don't think they are concerned about employment. And
well, she said they are, to be
well,
fair.
Yes, but
in that everywhere all at once.
Yes, but at the
approach,
Australian yeah. Business Economist dinner, where she had the fireside chat a week ago, I was there, and she basically said unemployment rate was where it should be. Okay, that was one of the big surprises for me. She didn't say a lot that night.
This was when it was 4.5%.
Yes.
It's a bit of a Mandy Rice Davies statement. You know, she has to say they're concerned about unemployment. The reality is full employment is a euphemism for whatever the unemployment rate is when inflation is where it should be.
I'm pretty sure she said this the other night too. We just need to feel our way through it. But there seems to me that we're doing an awful lot of touchy-feely stuff when we're supposed to be hard-nosed economists, you know, and obviously none of our models work perfectly, but there are a lot of people at the Reserve Bank who are working towards this.
All right, Nikki, and then Michael, you've just been made governor of the bank. You were made governor of the bank, appointed a week or so ago.
Oh, congratulations, Nikki.
Congratulations.
And to you too.
Co-governors.
What would you have done that's different? You seem to be saying her presentation was, a polite word, is all over the place, but you also seem to be saying that things are, to quote the Reserve Bank, highly uncertain. What would you do and how would you have presented what you did differently?
All right, I'll be brave and go first. So first, I mean, God help the country if I were the governor, but I would not have changed rates either. I would have sat. I think that was the right decision. My issue with the bank now, and has in fact been this year, is the way they communicate. I think they are learning lessons and this is a new paradigm for them being transparent. So I'm prepared to, you know, say, look, this is tricky. However, we're being left with less transparency, not more, when you come away from these media conferences. There's a little bit more in the statement on monetary policy, but even then we've got these risks that are identified that say, well, you know, anything could go wrong. I would like to see a clearer communication around our central path, and this may just be the communication, you know, style. A clearer communication around these are the things that we're worried about, these are the things we're not worried about, be open about it, be open about where there is dissent. I'm more worried. I can't believe that not one person on that board hasn't flagged the unemployment situation. Why are we suddenly looking at the quits rate, for example?
The rate of people leaving jobs.
Yes. Where the heck did that come from? Somebody's raised that from out of somewhere. And just the inflation number itself, it was such a shock to every forecaster. Every forecaster, including the bank, something is not right. There's a fishy smell about it. And I'm not saying the ABS is wrong, but maybe some of the one-off factors have actually bled into the trimmed mean and it's distorting that number this time around because it just doesn't smell right. Consumer demand is not that strong.
So you would have been honest. You would have said, oh, we don't quite know about this figure. It's quarterly. I guess it's there. And that different board members said different things. There was a view, there was concern. There was none of that in her press conference. It was all about, this is what I think And then, Michael, you were there. Nikki, you were watching. I was watching. A few minutes later, this is what I think. And it was not necessarily congruent. There was a lot of discussion. Is that what you're suggesting she should do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if we're going to be transparent, then be transparent. What are the things that are driving your decision? I don't think anybody has a problem with the decision, but the certainty behind that decision, surely we should be flagging, we're not entirely comfortable about where the unemployment rate is. We're not certain whether there's some latitude there. It's in the statement on monetary policy, but it didn't come out in the meeting.
Governor Pascoe.
Before I take up my governorship, could I just add to a comment by my co-governor mentioning the quit rate? Talk about cherry picking. The RBA now provides in the statement a little chart of full employment indicators. They play down the one big number, unemployment. You know, that's the gorilla. And there's a list of odds and sods where they cherry pick in this case, because the only thing that showed the labour force becoming a bit tighter was the quit rate, voluntary people leaving their job. And you know what, though? Yeah, it did move up, but it moved up from the lowest point it's been in the range for a quarter of a century. And the figure doesn't go back beyond the quarter of a century. It's only since 2020. So to use a technical term there, it's stuff all.
Would you have kept interest rates steady?
I would have kept interest rates steady. And Peter, thank you for that question. Beyond that, I'd be talking to APRA and the government looking for another tool. Something other than the big blunt instrument, which doesn't work terribly well except in a big blunt way.
And this other tool would be leaning on the banks to change their requirements for loans in order to take heat out of the housing market.
When you juice the first home buyer market and the investor market is also juiced, and you want to take away a bit of the juice, which banks can do.
Look, we're all critics here, although I've given both of you the chance to be governor, and actually I'd accept the salary as well. Economics and finance is what we're about here on The Economy Stupid on Radio National with me, Peter Martin. My guests this week, Reserve Bank Watchers Nikki Hutley and Michael Pascoe. Michael, might all this amount to nothing much if there's a massive financial collapse? I'm talking about the now stratospheric valuations of AI-related stocks. Nvidia is now worth more than $5 trillion, 3 months after climbing past $4 trillion. OpenAI is worth $500 billion and an infinite multiple now of its earnings because it's losing money. Money's pouring into everything associated with AI. Data centres, often from other AI and data centre companies. The top 10 AI companies in the US are now worth almost half the entire US share market. Is it all about to crash?
We absolutely, definitely have a bubble.
Bubble sounds benign. What is a bubble? You think bubble, that's nice.
a bubble is nice for a while, but when the bubble continues to inflate until it begins to look like a bomb about to go off, it becomes a worry. And obviously the cherry on the bubble is this massive investment that simply doesn't add up in terms of getting a return on the investment eventually. Jared Minnick wrote a fine piece for his clients pointing out that just for the listed AI 8, the big 8, just the AI 8 are going to have an investment stock of $1 trillion by the end of next year, and that's allowing for depreciation. To make a return on that, they've got to have massive revenue. And on his figuring, I won't go into the details of the technicalities because he understands it better than I do, those AI8 are going to need revenue of $925 billion to make a profit at the end of it of a 10% return on that investment. Now, that means they would have to come up with 10 products as good as Microsoft's 365. Microsoft Office 365 is outrageously successful. Will we have 10 outrageously successful AI companies to justify the money? I can't see it. And at some point, the investors will say, show us the money, and it's not there.
Nikki, does history repeat, and what has history shown us? And will it be different this time, to use the cliche?
Well, it might be, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the Microsoft 365 type subscription, because don't forget about defence applications, and there's potentially a lot of money there. But interestingly, there was a study done back in 1998 in the US. They looked at 51 major innovations from 1825 to the year 2000, starting with the steam train and ending with the smartphone. About three quarters of these technologies generated stock market bubbles, but some of them were absolutely transformational.
Oh, like the railways. We're left with the railways. The people who invested in the 1840s lost their money, but Britain is left with the railways.
Multiple examples.
We're left with the internet after the tech wreck.
That's right. So obviously we tend to think of bubbles as being alarming, and they do distort the allocation of capital. And obviously in 1929, you know, the ultimate bubble we saw caused incredible economic harm. But so many of these greatest innovations have led to incredible productivity gains over the long term. And the question is the short-term loss worth the long-term gains? But if we have a collapse of the scale that we had for the dot-com bubble back around the turn of the century, when the NASDAQ dropped 80% peak to trough, that would basically take about 80% of GDP growth from the US economy alone. And of course, every country in the world has investors. I'm probably a little bit more of an optimist. The fact that we're all talking about this now, that we're thinking it through, you know, I remember back in 1987, I was a very young economist, and I do remember saying, possibly to you, Peter Martin, on the ABC, oh, you know, this looks like a technical correction on the Friday. Look, I was getting married the next weekend. My mind might have been distracted. But the point is, we weren't necessarily as worried as we should be. And the way that we are focusing on this now, what does it mean? Who's lending to whom? A lot of this, people are not worried because it is not debt, it's private equity. And so in terms of bank stability, that's not as much necessarily of an issue. So I'm not saying there isn't a bubble. There clearly valuations are ludicrous. But I'm also saying we do need to think maybe a little bit differently this time around, because AI, particularly from defence, and we know there's a Trump-led defence spending boom, and AI and defence are inextricably linked.
Is there something, Michael, that is really different about this apparent bubble? Really different. Every other one, the bellboys got in, your shoeshine people, everyone started buying stocks. The ABC is running a series about Christopher Skase at the moment. Everyone wanted a piece of it. What we're seeing now is one of the most searched terms on Google, you can look at the graph I did this morning, it shot up in October, is AI bubble. People aren't talking about how it's a good thing to be part of. They're talking about how it's about to collapse. And we didn't see this in earlier bubbles, earlier crashes.
No, nowhere near to the extent. I mean, the crash of 87, viewed through the rear vision mirror, it was a technical correction. In historical terms, huh, what was that? Very exciting at the time. This time, yes, the different thing about it is the amount of fear around what is obvious, that there is a level of investment happening, and it is beginning to draw in a fair bit of debt too, particularly around the edges, and some of the big players are beginning to borrow. Meta has just gone off balance sheet for $30 billion, which is another interesting path to follow. But the fear is happening. What is odd about it, as you point out, is that the money is still pouring in. There was a note from a Citi analyst that was quoted somewhere I read, and Citi made the point that the latest leg of the bull market isn't driven by euphoria, rather it's driven by anxiety and obligations. Investors aren't chasing returns, they're chasing benchmarks.
This is our super fund system, right? They can't afford not to invest in something that everyone else is investing. Otherwise, they'll do badly.
And it's FOMO. Not just our super fund. It's FOMO and TINA as well. Fear of missing out, and there is no alternative. And heavens knows money is running around the world looking for alternatives, and everything is overvalued on most historical markers.
So it might be that even though we can see ourselves heading towards something, we can't stop ourselves. Nikki, can I ask a question about what would happen if the boom doesn't collapse? If these stratospheric valuations do turn out to be justified, if AI works, replaces scores and scores of jobs, wipes out entire occupations, might that be worse?
It doesn't look pretty either way that you look at it. And some interesting modelling out of Victoria University's Centre for Policy Studies looking at the types of job losses, but also significant job gains. You'd be perhaps surprised to know that the biggest sector gaining jobs are cleaners, cleaning staff, because people have more money and obviously there are more buildings. We need to do that. But there are massive, massive tens of thousands of job losses across all sorts of industries. The thing that worries me the most about this is if we are moving towards that point, if we have a higher base rate of unemployment, who's funding that? Who's funding society? Because these companies, the megatechs, don't pay taxes the way other companies do. Government isn't getting the revenue to redistribute it. And that, to me, is something we really ought to be talking about. We are into sort of a technocracy where they decide where the money goes. They already do in many ways. They're deciding where philanthropic funds go, not government selected by the people. They decide where they, you know, spend the vast profits they have. Fair enough. But if it's not equitably redistributed, we're in for just a world that you know, it's the realm of sci-fi movies at the moment, but something we certainly should be thinking about more.
So the money being justified is actually scarier than a mere bubble that's going to burst and cost a lot of people their shirts. And the thing about the unemployment side, if unemployment got back up to 10%, yeah, that'd be bad and painful, but it's been there before and we didn't change society. If it goes to 20%, yeah, then it takes a crisis to really change policy.
On that cheery note, I will say thank you, but as is traditional, before we go, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Nikki?
Well, I'm off to COP30 in Belém next week to go and see what the policy wonks, the governments of the world and civil society think about our next moves on climate action around the world. It's a very significant COP because every country has to come up with their next lot of plans, their nationally determined contributions, their targets for emissions reduction. So it's the money's on the line now. We know we've probably breached 1.5 degrees. You know, the records are being broken in terms of climate change in an alarming and very difficult way. We have to do something. The clock is close to midnight. So, you know, I will be hoping that amidst many of us who retain a slight skerrick of optimism that we can do it, that that optimism is in fact justified.
It sounds trivial in comparison, but are you rooting for Adelaide for the site for next year's COP, Council of Parties on Climate Change?
Look, I think it'd be fantastic if Adelaide won it. I think it would hopefully, you know, demonstrate, wave the flag for Australia, you know, bring even more investment into renewables, green economy, and we need to transform our economy because fossil fuels are the past. Green tech is the future, and whether it happens today and whether it happens messily in the future, it's going to happen.
Michael, what should we be keeping an eye out for?
Look, I have a problem with keeping an eye out for anything these days because every day or week the Trump administration manages to come up with something that could not be imagined. And I'm almost at the point, as we are officially in the silly season in November these days, it starts earlier, I almost just don't want to look out for whatever the toddler king is going to do next because I find it increasingly scary. I find the combination of Trump and the crisis of climate an absolutely evil conjunction that leaves me feeling pessimistic.
What a year. Think about where things were when we began. Admittedly, there was the climate problem, but we did not have the US president. We did not have the AI boom as we now have. Nikki, Michael Pascoe, finance editor, business journalist and Reserve Bank watcher for a long time now. And Nikki Hutley is an independent economist who's a counsellor with the Climate Council, about to head to Brazil. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Peter. A pleasure.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you've any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.